the compact. So it came to pass. Jacob had set up his camp not far from the city, near a group of ancient terebinth and mulberry trees, which seemed to him sacred, in a rolling stretch of meadow and ploughland out of which the rock Gerizim arose, bare above but fertile below. In the distance one saw the bald cliffs of Mount Ebal. From here he sent three men to Shechem with presents for Hamor the shepherd, a basket of pigeons, bread made of pressed fruits, a lamp shaped like a duck, and some beautiful jars painted with fish and birds. And he sent word that Jacob, the mighty traveller, would treat with the heads of the city under the gate concerning sojourn and rites. In Shechem they were relieved and delighted. The hour of meeting was appointed, and when it arrived, Hamor, the gouty man, came out of the east gate with his household train, and Sichem his son, a fidgety youth, and also Weser-ke-Bastet came in a fresh garland of flowers, out of curiosity, accompanied by several cats. And Yaakov ben Yitzchak, in all his dignity, placed himself on the other side, attended by his oldest servant, Eliezer, and his older sons, upon whom he had enjoyed perfect courtesy for the occasion. And so they met under the city gate, and held speech together, there and before it, for the gate was a heavy structure, projecting both outside and inside in hall-shaped bays, and the inside was the market square and place of judgment, and a press of people had come hither behind the heads of council to look on and listen at the business, which proceeded with all due and proper forms, and got to the heart of the matter only with difficulty, so that the sitting lasted 6 hours, and the merchants in the marketplace drove a thriving business. After the first salutations, the two groups sat down opposite each other on camp stools, mats, and carpets, and refreshments were handed, spiced wine and curds with honey. For a long time the conversation was confined to the health of the heads and their families, then passed to the state of communications on both sides of the outlet, and thence to matters even more remote. But by slow degrees, reluctantly and with shoulder shruggings, they got round to the object of the meeting, casually at first, each side seeming to dissuade the other from talking of it, and treating it with contempt on grounds of their higher humanity, precisely because it was the one and only topic of discussion, and the actual reason for the meeting. For after all, it is just this indulgence in the superfluous, this submission to artificial hierarchies, and the unashamed wasting of time on their account, which differentiates the civilized from the natural, and makes up the sum of human values. The impression which Jacob's personality made upon the inhabitants was of the best. They realized, if not at first sight, then after only a little conversation, whom they had before them. This was a man of God, and prince of men, aristocrat by his possession of gifts of the Spirit, in virtue of which likewise his person was ennobled. It was the working of that same nobility which had been from time immemorial the mark of the successor or reincarnation of Abraham in the eyes of the people. Quite independently of birth, basing itself upon form and spirit, it had conferred upon this race the gift of spiritual leadership. The moving mildness and profundity of Jacob's gaze, his consummate propriety, his fastidious gestures, the quaver in his voice, his cultured and florid speech, moving in strophe and antistrophe, rhythmical thought and mythical allusion, so charmed them all, in particular the gouty Hamor, that early in the proceedings he stood up and crossed over to kiss the sheik, amid loud applause from the populace in the inner hall. The stranger's actual business, which, as they all knew, had to do with permanent and legal settlement among them, that was indeed a matter of some difficulty for the head of the city, since if it became known higher up that he, Hamor, was parcelling out the country to the Kabirites, it might get him into trouble in his old age. But reassured by an exchange of looks with the head of the garrison, who was as much taken with Jacob as was Hamor himself, he opened the negotiations with a sweeping courtesy, and the too-sweeping proposal that Jacob should quite simply take land and rights as a present, following it up with a thumping price, 100 silver shekels for 12.5 acres of cornland, and adding, in expectation of much tough haggling to ensue, that money had no meaning between such a purchaser and himself. But Jacob did not bargain. He was moved in his soul, exalted by thoughts of recurrence, duplication, and the past made present. He was Abraham, come from the east, buying from Ephron the ploughed land and the field of the double cave for a burying place. Had the founder haggled over the price with the head of Hebron and with the children of Heth? The centuries were as though they were not. What had been was again. The wealthy Abraham, the wealthy Jacob, out of the east. They struck bargains in dignity, without more ado. Chaldean slaves brought up the weighing scales and the stone weights. Old Eliezer advanced with an earthen jar full of ring silver. Hamor's clerks rushed up, squatted down, and began to write out the articles of peace and agreement according to justice and the law. The money was weighed out for ploughland and pasture, legal and sacred the contract. Accursed might he be who broke the bond. Jacob's people became duly accredited citizens of Shechem. They might go in and out at will through the city gates. They might go abroad through the land and trade in it. Shechem's sons might take their daughters to wife, and the daughters of Shechem their sons as husbands. It was established by law, and he who opposed it should be bare of honor for his whole life long. Likewise, the trees should be his on the field Jacob had bought, and who brought it in question was an enemy to the law. In witness whereof, Weser Kebastet pressed his seal ring with the scarab into the clay, Hamor his stone, and Jacob the cylindrical seal that hung round his neck. So it was done. They exchanged kisses and flatteries, and thus it was that Jacob settled in the land of Canaan and near the city of Shechem. Jacob dwells before Shechem. Knowest thou? Well, I know it. But when Israel's shepherds later gathered round their fires and exchanged fine language, they were far enough from knowing it well. They suppressed some of the facts, and rearranged others all for the sake of the story, and with perfectly clear consciences. They said nothing at all of the wry faces that were made by the sons of Jacob, particularly by Simeon and Levi, even while the contract was being drawn up. And they would have it that the bargain was signed after the affair between Sychem and Dinah had already begun, and begun, in fact, quite otherwise than as they knew it. They would have it that a certain condition made to Sychem with reference to the daughter of Jacob had actually been part of the compact, whereas that condition had been quite another matter, and had come up at quite another time than the time and the connection they pretended to know so well. Let me explain. The contract was the beginning. Without it, the settlement at Shechem could not have taken place, nor the other events have followed on. They had lived in their tents before the city, at the entrance to the valley, for almost 4 years before the complications ensued. They planted their wheat in the fields and their barley on the loam of the fields. They gathered the fruit of their olive trees, pastured their flocks, and traded with them in the countryside. They dug a well where they had settled, 14 ells deep and very wide, and lined it with masonry. Jacob's well. But why such a deep and wide well? When the whole valley abounded in springs, and the city possessed a well before its gate, what need had the children of Israel to dig themselves one? Good, and they did not need it at first. They did not dig it at once when they had settled down, but somewhat later, when it became clear that it was a necessity of existence for them, the Ebreim, to be independent in the matter of a water supply, and to have on their own ground a source that would not run dry even in the greatest drought. The compact had been made, and the brotherhood sealed, and whoever misconstrued it, his entrails should be the price. But it had been made and sealed by the chiefs, even though with the applause of the populace. And in the eyes of the people of Shechem, the people of Jacob still remained strangers and wanderers. Not such very agreeable or harmless ones either. Rather vain and dictatorial indeed, boasting of their superior spirituality, and at the same time capable of looking after their own interest in the wool and cattle trade, in a way that made one's self-esteem suffer in comparison. In other words, the Brotherhood did not go very deep. There were certain shallow spots, one of these being in respect of the water supply. It had not been explicitly mentioned in the contract, and before very long, the Hebrews were refused the use of the available sources. Hence, the great well, the well of Jacob, the existence of which is a witness to the fact that even before the more serious troubles, things stood between the seed of Israel and the people of Shechem, much as they were in the habit of standing between nomad Kabirites and the settled owners of the land, and not at all as they should have stood in virtue of the contract signed before the gate of the city. Jacob knew this, and did not know it. That is to say, he looked the other way, and directed his mild gaze upon everyday things and spiritual matters. At that time, his sweet-eyed Rachel was still with him, whom he had so toilsomely wooed, and so hardly won, and rescued, and brought to the land of his fathers, his one true and beloved wife, delight of his eyes, a balm to his heart, and refreshment to his senses. Joseph, her offspring, the one true son, grew apace, being at that charming age between childhood and boyhood, and turning indeed into so lovely, clever, bewitching, and beguiling a lad that the father's heart swelled with pride at sight of him, and the older sons had already begun to exchange glances over the follies their father committed in his doting on the sharp-tongued brat. Moreover, Jacob was often away on journeys. He got into touch with those of the faith in city and country, visited the spots sacred to the God of Abraham in the valleys and on the heights, and in many a discussion expounded the essence of the only and most high. It is certain that he first of all went southwards to embrace his father, from whom he had been separated for a lifetime, and to confirm himself in a blessing by which he had so obviously profited. For Yitzchak was still living, a very old man, and long since wholly blind, whereas Rebekah, years before, had descended into the kingdom of the shades. Her death had been the cause of Isaac removing the place of his burnt offering from the tree Yahweh El Olam at Beersheba to the oracle Terebinth by Hebron, in the immediate neighborhood of the Double Cave, where he had buried his cousin's daughter and sister bride, and where, after a little while, he too, Yitzchak, the rescued sacrifice, after long and eventful life, would be laid to rest and be mourned by his sons Jacob and Esau. But that was later, when Jacob came down broken in spirit after Rachel's death, with her infant slayer, the newborn Ben-Oni, Benjamin. The Vintage. Four times the wheat and barley were green and golden on Shechem fields. Four times the anemones in the valley blossomed and died. And eight times the people of Jacob had held sheep-shearing. For the fleece of his spotted yearlings grew again in the turning of a hand, and he had a rich yield of wool from them twice a year, in Sivan, as well as in the autumn month of Tishri. Then the feast of the vintage was held in the city, and on the vine-clad terraces of Gerizim, at the full moon of the autumn equinox, when the year renewed itself. Everywhere was shouting, processions were on every hand, and harvest offerings in town and valley, for they had plucked the grapes with singing, and trodden them with naked feet in the stone winepress, and their legs were purple to the thighs, and the sweet blood flowed through a trough into the vat, and they kneeled down with laughter, and let it run into their jars and wineskins to ferment. And when the wine was racked, there began the seven-day feast, and they sacrificed a tenth of the first things of cattle and sheep, of corn, oil, and must, feasted and drank. They brought to Adonai, the great god, lesser gods for attendance in his house, and himself they carried in his ship, in procession on their shoulders, with drums and cymbals, and bore him through all the land, to bless anew the fields and the vineyards. But in the midst of the feast, on the third day, they held music and dancing before the city and the castle, and in the presence of all who cared to come thither, women and children not excepted. Old Hamor was carried out in a chair, and the fidgety Sychem, also in a chair, with a train of women and eunuchs. Officials, merchants, and smaller folk were there, And Jacob came from his tents with wives and sons and servants, and they all sat down together where the music was, and the dancing should be performed. This was beneath the olive trees in a broad part of the valley made by the falling away of the sacred mount, where it stood up rocky on top and smiling below. In the gorges of the Mount of Cursing, goats were clambering in search of dry grass. The afternoon was warm and blue, the waning light kind to all men and things, gilding the figures of the dancers, who, with embroidered bands about their heads and hips, and metallic dust in their lashes, their eyes lengthened out by painting the corners, postured with rolling bellies before the musicians, turning their heads away from the tambours on which they played. The musicians squatted and struck their lutes and lyres and filled the air with the high whining of their pipes. Those behind the musicians beat time with their hands, and others sang, squeezing their throats with their hands to make a plaintive sound. There were men dancers as well, bearded and naked, with the tails of animals bound round them. They leaped like goats and tried to catch the maidens who escaped them by sudden swerving of their lithe young forms. There was playing at ball, at which the females were very clever, folding their arms while keeping several balls in the air at a time, or while one of them perched herself on another's hip. Great was the satisfaction of town-dwellers and tent-dwellers, and if Jacob did not care for the hubbub and the drumming, still he put a good face on it for the sake of the people, and even courteously beat time with his hand now and then. And now it was that Sychem, the son of the castle, saw Dinah, the daughter of the Ebrim, when she was 13 years old, and first looked on her with longing and could never cease to desire her. She sat with her mother, Leah, on their mat near the musicians, opposite Sychem's seat, and he looked at her and could not turn away his dazzled eyes. She was not beautiful, no child of Leah's was, but the charm of youth went out from her, and she drew him with a clinging sweetness, like the threads of date honey, until Sychem was like the fly in the honey-pot who draws up his sticky legs to see if he can get free if he wishes, does not seriously wish, for the honey is so sweet, yet is frightened to death, seeing that he cannot, however much he tries. So it was with Sychem, who squirmed about on his little camp-stool and was covered with blushes. She had a dark little face with fringes of black hair under the headcloth, and long, narrow eyes of sticky black, and a fatal sweetness. They kept going cross-eyed under the gaze of the sore-smitten youth. Her nose had wide nostrils, with a gold ring swinging from the partition between them. The mouth was a red cavity, with wide and painfully twisted lips, and as good as no chin. Her ungirdled smock of blue and red wool covered only one shoulder, and the bare one was extremely charming in its slenderness, loveliness itself. Matters were not improved when she raised her arm to put her hand to the back of her head, exposing to Sychem's gaze the damp curls in the little armpit and the delicate small breasts standing out firm under shift and smock. Very damaging, too, was the effect of the little dark feet with copper anklets and rings of soft gold on all the toes save the big ones. But almost worst of all were the little golden-brown hands with painted nails, the fingers covered with rings as well. She played with them in her lap, looking wise and childlike at once, and when Sychem thought of how these hands might caress him at their nuptials, his head swam and he gasped for breath. But it was of the nuptials, the wedding night, he thought at once, and thought of nothing else. To speak with Dinah herself and pay court to her otherwise than with his eyes was forbidden him by custom. But even on the way home, and after they had reached the castle, he dinned in his father's ears that he could not live, that he would fade away and die without the Kabirite girl, and that the old man must go out and buy her for his couch, otherwise his life was a matter of days. What was there for the gouty Hamor to do save to be carried by two men and taken to Jacob's house of skins, to bow before him, to call him brother, and with much circumlocution speak to him of the heart's desire of Sychem, his son, offering rich mourning presents in the hope that Dinah's father might consent to the match? Jacob was surprised and dismayed. He was embarrassed by conflicting feelings. From a worldly point of view, he had ambitions toward establishing relations with the princely house of the land. They would be useful to him and to his seed. And he was moved, too, by memories of distant days, of his own wooing of Rachel from the devil Laban, and how Laban had put him off, exploited and betrayed him. Now he himself was in the role of Laban. It was his daughter on whom a youth cast eyes of desire, and he was not minded to behave as Laban had done. On the other hand, he had lively doubts of the propriety of such a union. As for Dinah, he had never taken much notice of the little minx, all his affection being centered on the captivating Joseph. Nor had he ever received from on high any guidance regarding her. Still, she was his only daughter. The wooing of Sychem enhanced her value in his eyes, and he bethought him that he must take care not to throw away this hitherto unprized possession. Had not Abraham made Eliezer put his hand beneath his thigh to swear that he would choose no wife for Yitzhak, the chosen son, from the daughters of Canaan among whom he lived, but would find him one from their own seed and among their kindred in the east? And had not Yitzhak passed on the prohibition, saying to himself, the chosen one, "Thou shalt not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan"? Dinah was but a girl, and a child of the unchosen to boot, and it was probably not so important as in the case of the bearer of the blessing how she should be bestowed in marriage. Yet it was also written that one should keep the vows made before the Lord.